Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Our love affair with a 30-year mortgage, the guy who grows your pumpkins, and the economics of your delayed plane trip home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. And this is your Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, November 26th. Thanks for joining us. If you're traveling this week, I'm willing to bet you're looking at the Weather Channel or hitting refresh a lot on storm maps. Flights across the country are being canceled or delayed because of storms. So when that happens, how do airlines make all those cancellations work for their bottom line? Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
We used to hear more horror stories about passengers trapped for hours and hours, sometimes without food or even working bathrooms. In 2010, the feds ruled that airlines would incur big fines for those kinds of incidents, and they're down. That's the good news. The bad news: more flights get canceled, and airlines wait longer to board passengers, which can itself mean longer delays. Ken Button studies aviation economics at George Mason University.
People are sitting in the lounge. They're not on the plane. A slot on the runway becomes available, and then the airline simply can't take advantage of it.
Christopher Elliott writes a consumer advice column for National Geographic Traveler magazine. He says the trade-off has worked.
It's better to be inconvenienced right there at your point of origin than stuck somewhere, or to even, God forbid, be stuck on a plane that's parked on a runway somewhere and can't go anywhere.
John Heimlich is an economist with the airlines trade group Airlines for America. He says some passengers might prefer a wait on the tarmac to a canceled flight.
If you're not there for Thanksgiving dinner, it's not that much fun arriving on Friday, missing a wedding, missing a key business meeting, missing a college graduation.
To adjust, he says airlines have started notifying passengers earlier when their flight could have a problem, sending texts.
Hey, it's not going to be the 10 o'clock flight, but it's going to be the 3 p.m. flight.
And their social media. United tweeted this morning about options for travelers to rebook for cities where the weather was bad. Cleveland, D.C., New York. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
You're going to like this next story. I guarantee it. Okay. I have been trying all day to come up with a decent play off the famous Men's Warehouse tagline and failing. But here's the deal. Joseph A. Bank, the other big men's retailer, tried to buy Men's Warehouse, and they turned down the deal. But then today, 2 weeks later, Men's Warehouse made the same offer to Joseph A. Bank. This rare reversal is known as a Pac-Man defense. If one company eats the other, they will now be the biggest seller of men's suits out there. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
Both Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Bank are known for selling low-priced menswear, often through promotional deals like this one.
Buy a sport coat at Joseph A. Bank. Get a second sport coat or blazer, plus any two dress or casual pants absolutely free at Joseph A. Bank.
These are promotional chains that market their clothing to the middle class. And at a time when the middle class is shrinking, demand for suits in general is down since the recession, says retail analyst Nicoletta Panteva.
Partly due to declining discretionary incomes and also partly due to high unemployment, which limited men's need to purchase and wear suits to the office.
Despite an overall decline in menswear sales, Joseph A. Bank and Men's Warehouse have grown post-recession.
Men's Warehouse has grown at 4.6%, while Joseph A. Banks has grown at 10.4% per year.
A merger between the two companies could help fend off competition from other brick-and-mortar retailers.
Some of it's also the discount stores, which is hit and miss, but Ross, TJ Maxx, Marshalls, Stein Mart, those places have some pretty good values as well.
Andy Gilchrist is the author of the Encyclopedia of Men's Clothing. He says more discount stores are offering name brands that could lure customers away from Joseph A. Bank and Men's Warehouse, together or apart. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, we're going to play the happy music later. We'll have details when we do the numbers. you dash into a store today for a few Thanksgiving ingredients, take a look at the cans of pumpkin. I'm willing to bet you'll see the red and white logo of Libby's. Libby's is now owned by Nestle, but it dominates the canned pumpkin market. And before those cans got to the grocery store, before the pumpkins got into the cans, they were grown by a farmer, like Phil Frederick. He's in Green Valley, Illinois. Hi, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you very much.
So I have in my mind, of course, kind of a Halloween pumpkin, but that's not really the kind of pumpkin you grow, is it?
No, it gets confused very often when you say you're a pumpkin grower. That's usually the first misconception of a pumpkin farmer is that it's the jack-o'-lantern style and not the consuming style.
So what does your pumpkin look like?
It looks a lot like a regular jack-o'-lantern, except for the color. It's not near as orange as one of the decorative pumpkins. It's just more of kind of like a light tan. But they've kind of bred these pumpkins so, you know, you get more actual fiber out of them than you would in a pumpkin that you would carve up.
How did you end up growing pumpkins for Libby's, the company that makes those canned pumpkins that a lot of people buy at Thanksgiving?
Basically because we're pretty close to them. They were already in the area when I graduated from high school, and we just were able to get a contract with them, and it's just led to, you know, a little bit more all the time.
So how does it all work? They're owned by Nestle, and I gather you get the seeds from Nestle, yes?
Yes, they bring us the seed. We basically do everything else like we do it in any other crop. We plant it, we cultivate it, we water it. We try to take care of the weeds and so forth. But they do harvest it because it does take special equipment to harvest that. So they come in and they actually put the pumpkins in rows is what they do, and then they run a machine there and pick them up and throw them in a wagon that then goes and dumps them into a semi in the field.
Is it fair to say that people who eat a pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving, they've eaten your pumpkins?
Yeah, there's probably a good chance they've had it along the line because we have grown quite a few over the years. Of course, there are quite a few acres, so it could come from neighboring farms around, but yeah, there is definitely that possibility that that has happened.
You've done this for a while. Do you like what you do?
Most of the time. Probably like anybody. Probably like anybody. There's always good days and bad days, but I don't know what else I would do. I mean, you just kind of take the bad with the good and you work through it like you would in anything.
Phil Frederick is a pumpkin farmer. He's been doing it for 35 years. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Some good housing news today. Housing prices are up across the country. Permits to build new homes also up. All part of this next story about a love affair, a really long-term one, remarkably stable, between America and a loan. Yesterday, we told you about the history of the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Today, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports on our attachment to it and whether it still makes sense.
We live in a fast, fast world where jobs are temporary, companies fetishize short-term profits. Every moment we're supposed to be optimizing, optimize, optimize, optimize.
So in some ways, the 30-year mortgage is an anachronism for the go-go capitalism that we live under today.
Lewis Hyman is a history professor at the ILR School at Cornell University. Most of our financial lives are in flux, demanding constant attention, except our mortgages. Nearly 90% of the home loans issued during the first half of this year were 30-year fixed-rate loans, where you pay the same amount every single month.
It also speaks to the way in which most Americans still want to have stability in their lives. So there's this real disconnect between the sort of larger movements of capitalism and how we actually would prefer to live our lives.
The 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is remarkably pro-you and anti-go-go capitalism. It stretches the payment out over a long period of time, protects you if interest rates go up, lets you refinance if interest rates go down. It can be a little hard to understand why, when so many other facets of our lives have been turned over to the market, we have government policy that favors, that actually creates this dependence on the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Here's President Obama in August.
We should preserve access to safe and simple mortgage products like the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. That's something families should be able to rely on when they're making the most important purchase of their lives.
Everybody claps. But is this love a love for calm, for predictability in our otherwise unpredictable lives, or something more? The answer is, yep, both.
The stability and the ability to build up savings without really thinking about it, which is very important, are the two biggest benefits to the individual.
Ellen Seidman is a fellow at the Urban Institute. She says there are also social benefits. There's evidence that
homeownership generates a greater interest in maintenance of the home, in stability, and greater civic interest in the community.
So the cheap 30-year fixed-rate mortgage has a lot of feel-good going for it. It can do good things for people, for neighborhoods. But also, the economy is counting on it. Long-term, low-cost mortgages and other government-sponsored affordable housing programs help more people buy more homes, which means more people remodeling, refurnishing, keeping our consumer economy going strong. No surprise, then, that businesses like home builders, realtors, mortgage lenders find themselves lining up with housing advocates in favor of keeping the 30-year home loan.
They're a very powerful lobbying force, and they'll want more housing. I just want to keep this game perpetuated.
Anthony Sanders is a finance professor at George Mason University.
If I want to get booed ceremoniously, I should show up at a National Association of Realtors meeting and tell them we're going to get rid of affordable housing policy.
There are costs to keeping things going the way they are. Sanders says homeowners pay more for fixed-rate mortgages than adjustable-rate mortgages.
Even when it saves them enormous amounts of money.
There are costs to the government from housing-friendly tax policies, costs as the Fed borrows money to keep interest rates low, and costs to us taxpayers when government-backed mortgages go bad.
So we're sort of used to very, very high levels of government subsidization of the housing market. We subsidized to the point that it blew up, but we'll continue doing it because that's what everyone knows right now.
Freddie and Fannie currently guarantee trillions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities. Whether it's familiarity or risk aversion or the fear of another drop in the housing market, the lure of stability for me and you and our communities and our economy could be enough to keep the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage going well into the future. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, the first country that could be wiped out by climate change.
One large wave would move across these islands and knock down everything from one side to the other.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks rose today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average nudged up a quarter point to close at 16,072. The NASDAQ advanced 23 points, about a half percent, to end the day at 4017. The S&P 500 rose just a touch to close at 1802. Luxury retailer Tiffany shown up 8.7%. Its third quarter sales beat expectations, and the company raised its profit forecast for the full year. Europe's markets fell. Germany's DAX dipped 1%. Britain's FTSE fell 0.9%. France's CAC 40 retreated about a half percent. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, serious business. President Obama pardons the national Thanksgiving turkey. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for October. And what would you do with an unexpected $5,000? That's one of the questions on an annual survey from the Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association It focuses on consumers' holiday spending plans and debt concerns. Results released tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in all this week for Kai Rizdahl. Pope Francis has grabbed a lot of headlines lately by blessing a disfigured man, focusing on the poor, abstaining from some of the fancier trappings of the Vatican, and now, in his first major piece of writing as Pope, taking a pretty big whack at capitalism. In Trickle-Down Economics, Francis says, quote, "The excluded are still waiting." Still, it's a little hard to say how this message will trickle down to his flock. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
In his document, Pope Francis says,
"How can it be that there is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points?"
That's Dennis Cody, editor of National Catholic Reporter, reading from the Pope's address. He says the church has taken on communism and even non-proliferation in its time.
He's setting the agenda for where he wants the church to go.
It's a message to make poverty and inequality a priority, not just to the 1.1 billion Catholics in the world. It's also a directive to all the charities and the dioceses run by the church that this issue should enjoy a higher profile.
I would like to believe that it could make a lot of difference.
This is Brian Porter Such, professor of history at the University of Michigan.
It seems that it's been one of these messages that people hear when they wish to hear it and ignore when it's more convenient to ignore it.
The widening gap between rich and poor in many countries and the emphasis on wealth accumulation would suggest that it's a message that has been often ignored so far. Such says even in very Catholic Poland, the Pope's words are used selectively by political leaders. But the new Pope's emphasis, combined with his bully pulpit, or ambo as it's known in Catholicism, isn't insignificant. Charles Curran is professor of human values at Southern Methodist University.
The very fact that you're writing this article, and you and many others, is proof of the fact that he has a teaching voice and that that will be heard by some people.
Money must serve, not rule, wrote Pope Francis. Amen to that. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The government shutdown might seem like old news to you. It's been more than a month since it ended, and Washington's mostly gotten back to work. But there's a web of contractors out there who rely on the government for their livelihoods. And some of them are still waiting on payments that were delayed by the shutdown. And as Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, they don't know what's in store for them next year.
Davis Interiors outfits the insides of Navy and Coast Guard ships. It makes furniture, wall coverings, you name it. Roxanne Metzger's parents started the business in 1955 when she was 6 months old.
And we have invoices from back in the 60s.
She shows me some of the memorabilia she saved over the years. Business used to be steady. Not anymore. The government is late paying its bills because the Pentagon officers who make the payments were furloughed during last month's government shutdown. Metzger is owed $250,000 by companies known as prime contractors. They get the government contracts and farm some of the work out to her. She called one of them recently who hasn't paid her in months.
And I called the other day because it's going on 90 days. And he said, "Well, I wish I could help you, but we have not been paid. The government owes us $1.6 million.
Metzger says her business is down by half from last year. She's having to reach into her personal savings to keep it afloat. Her bank won't extend her line of credit, and no money's coming in. Metzger comes close to tears as she describes her worst fears.
My nightmare is having to close the business. I have nightmares of losing my house and is losing everything I have."
Metzger has already lost 6 workers. She laid them off last spring after the first wave of sequestration cuts. The 26 employees who remained were reduced to 4-day weeks. Some of them took second jobs. Purchasing agent Angela Wallace is working 3 jobs. She cleans offices when her day job's done.
I start at between 7:30. And I don't get home till like 10:30. That's like 14 hours a day, really.
Davis Interiors factory workers are back up to 40 hours a week, running noisy metal cutting and pressing machines. Kevin Slate has worked as a welder at Davis for 12 years. He shudders at the thought of going back to 32-hour weeks.
I couldn't go back to 32 again. I'd have to probably find another job. I went through it all summer. and it was real hard and tough. I barely made it.
The whole company barely made it. Roxanne Metzger puts on a brave business-as-usual face for her employees, examining newly unwrapped fabric in the sewing room, giving directions, patting a back here, telling a joke there. But she's clearly worried about sequestration cuts scheduled for 2014. So are the government's multiple contractors and subcontractors across the country. They're all suffering from sequestration uncertainty. Steve Fuller is an economist at George Mason University in Virginia. He says, yes, let's tighten our belts, but not at the expense of subcontractors like Davis Interiors, whose specialized skills will be needed by the ships of the future.
It's part of our defense as having a well-prepared workforce. That's as important as having military personnel ready to go to the front.
Roxanne Metzger wants Davis Interiors to stick around, too. She's trying to diversify, offering her design and upholstery services to local businesses like restaurants. But she has few takers. Nobody in Norfolk wants to spend money now. They're all afraid of what'll happen if sequestration hits again next year. In Norfolk, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a country in the Pacific called Kiribati. It's spelled like Kiribati. It's actually a pretty small place, a chain of islands. About 100,000 people live there. But it could become the first country to go completely underwater because of climate change. Jeffrey Goldberg visited the country, and he tells its story in the most recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So it's drowning Kiribati, even though it looks like it's written drowning Kiribati. Thank you for making sure I pronounce this correctly.
Yes, it's a country that no one knows where it is and no one knows how to say its name.
And they have a very big problem creeping up all around them. Explain what it is.
The problem is that this is a country of 32 low-lying islands and then one high island that has been mined to death, so it's uninhabitable. The 32 low-lying islands or atolls are slowly drowning. The ocean is rising because of global warming, because of climate change, and the water is in certain places coming in.
How much time do they have?
The president of the country says that by about 2030, they're going to be in dire straits, much sooner if they experience any kind of extreme weather, and they're after the Philippines especially, they're very worried about that. Because one large wave would move across these islands and knock down everything from one side to the other. So he thinks by 2030 it's going to become fairly uninhabitable. Certainly by the end of this century, a lot of the atolls will just be underwater.
What are his options for trying to save his country or get his people out?
It's a very sad thing because they've been there. Their ancestors came 3,000 or more years ago. No one knows for sure, but at least 3,000 years ago from what is now Indonesia. So, you know, they've been there for 100 generations or more. And they understand, or they're beginning to understand, that they're going to have, if things continue the way they are, they're going to have to leave. And there's no one in the world is going to take 103 or by the time it happens, maybe 150,000 people in one large group. So the thinking is that they will have to be split up as a nation. Some will go to Australia, some will go to New Zealand, some will go to Fiji, and they will be a diaspora caused by climate change, maybe the first diaspora caused by climate change. And what the president is doing is he's trying to do intense vocational training for his citizens, nursing, mechanics, seamanship, so that instead of being refugees, they can be migrants with dignity, as he says.
When you did this story, the president said to you, you know, he was angry, but his anger wasn't going to make the U.S. and China stop burning coal.
Right. The State Department's position is that, you know, they're talking about reparations and it's a non-starter. These countries are not going to be paying billions of dollars to these people because of the consequences of climate change. The one other thing he said was that this should be a lesson for Americans because what's happening now in the Pacific will be happening in places like Florida, in New York. You could go right now to some of these islands in the Pacific and you'll get a good glimpse of the near future.
Did you feel guilty?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I feel guilty about everything, so yeah, I'm not the right person to ask. But to answer your question seriously, the astonishing thing about this place is that this is not an act of nature. It's they didn't cause this. We caused this. And so these islands are becoming slowly inundated because of the behavior of the industrialized North. I mean, they don't have industry. They're not burning anything. And so this is on us. It really is.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a columnist for Bloomberg View. His story, Drowning Kiribati, is in Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, perhaps not directly Thanksgiving-related, but from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The Bay Psalm Book, one of the world's rarest books, is being auctioned tonight, and it could fetch as much as $30 million. It was printed in 1640 by Puritans, who didn't like the Church of England's translations of the Bible. There are only 11 copies that remain in existence, and this one comes from the Old South Church in Boston. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow nudged up a quarter point, the NASDAQ advanced 23 points, about 0.5%, and the S&P 500 rose just a touch. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers are producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.